Argument this morning. We'll hear argument first, or this afternoon. We'll hear argument first in number 2007-1340, Kinetic Concepts against Blue Sky Medical. Now, as I understand it, Mr. Partridge, you'll be going first, taking 7 minutes. Mr. Dunner will follow, presumably on invalidity and infringement if he so chooses. And in the event that he raises infringement, then we will hear from both Mr. Ray on infringement and then you, Mr. Partridge, on invalidity.
Correct.
With Mr. Dunner to follow with 3 more minutes on infringement. So that's the way the arrangement has been set up?
Yes, sir.
Very good. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. As you know, my name is Scott Partridge. I represent Medela AG and Medela Inc. in this case, and we have appealed the finding of validity below, and we have asserted 2 legal errors with respect to validity. The first concerns the obviousness finding below, and the second concerns the definiteness of the claims. It's my intention here this afternoon to spend the 6 minutes and 30 seconds I have left discussing obviousness. If the court has questions about indefiniteness, obviously I'm quite happy to answer those.
Well, why didn't you raise anticipation on appeal?
Your Honor, that arose primarily because of the lack of claim construction with respect to treating the wound, which was a fundamental issue below. And when we opted to pursue our appeal in what issues were the appropriate issues for appeal, we decided to focus on obviousness. But your question raises what is, I think, a very important point with respect to the construction of the term treating a wound, facilitating the healing of a wound. Because if you find that those terms should be construed as the court initially did below, or as we asserted below, the court should interpret those terms, and then you turn to the claims and begin the obviousness analysis, and you ask yourself the first question, are there differences? When you turn to claims like Claim 13, with that construction in hand, with respect to the public uses of Cheriker and Jeter, distinguished from the article that was before the examiner, talking about the public uses and the presentations, the discussions they had with other doctors, I think you'll find that there aren't any differences, which is the quintessential state of obviousness in this case.
But on claim construction, what is then the dispute? Are you advocating the district court judge's original construction of the injury, wound being an injury? If that's the case, I guess I'm wondering what difference it makes.
We argued that the better construction, Your Honor, was the application of the understood meaning of wound at the time, which came from the Stedman Medical Dictionary, and a position that KCI took before the FDA as to the definition of wound with respect to these particular devices, which was more explicit and provided more guidance to the jury. When the court instructed initially, or when the court decided that the meaning of the term included giving medical care to an injury and stopped at that, that was a construction we felt that we could live with at trial because we thought that distinguishing a fistula from a wound would be easier for their experts to argue than saying that a fistula wasn't an injury. So I think it had a significant difference in how we went forward with the case with respect to the experts and the other witnesses in the case. The court initially, we went through this with Judge Ferguson in claim construction, and initially he agreed with that. 10 days into trial, he changed the construction. Now you have
to let me see if I understand, follow up on Judge Prost's question. As I understand it, it's the Stedman Medical Dictionary. Is that what it is? You were saying that that's the construction law to be
adopted. Yes, Your Honor.
And part of the Stedman definition is
trauma to tissue
resulting from a surgical incision, right?
One
something
of,
like that. Right?
One of two things, Your Honor. The first of which has to do with trauma. trauma to a tissue of the body.
Right.
And then it gives an example. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's in the briefs. And then the second example it gives is the one that you just identified, surgical incision.
And your contention is that Cherik or Jeter, in fact, was directed to fistulas caused by surgical incision.
They can be caused that way. It can occur in other ways, as I understand it, Your Honor, but that is the typical way that a fistula would occur during the course of a surgery. An opening would be created.
So your theory was that if the Stedman definition were adopted, the fistulas that were treated in Cherik or Jeter would come within that definition of a wound.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. There wouldn't be a debate about it. And instead of that being left to the jury to decide, which was a central issue in claim construction, and indeed in our briefing and in a letter brief the court requested, we actually identified the problem and said this is a central issue in the case, Your Honor. If you don't construe this term, we believe that they will try to argue the interpretation to the jury through experts, which is what happened. And this is no different than what the court addressed in the O2 Micro case, which was decided after our main brief but before our reply brief.
I'm not sure that I saw that the claim construction was explicitly argued to the jury. Can you refer me to where that happened?
Yes, Your Honor. If you, it wasn't argued as to the jury in the sense that we would at a Markman hearing, here's what the claim means. What instead happened was that during the discussion of the prior art, their expert in particular talked about the prior art as not disclosing treating a wound because it was a fistula. And if you look at the testimony of Dr. Orville at appendix page 204932, that's how he distinguished the prior art. That was the position that was taken in opening, in closing, and in the testimony of Dr. Orville. So the jury was left with respect to a term that appears in all 37 asserted claims, deciding what the term meant for purposes of applying the prior art. 6 days of deliberation, and I don't know if they simply gave up, but we have the verdict that we have. And I think...
Well, what about the fact, even if you're right, I mean, I think the other side points this out in their brief, that during prosecution, Cherik or Jeter was distinguished from the patent as a wound drainage device.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so wasn't there some basis that the jury could have relied on? Obviously, we don't know exactly what they relied on in order to sustain their obvious determination of non-obviousness.
Yes, Your Honor. And they could have done that, but should they have been doing that rather than the court as a matter of claim construction? Just as in O2 Micro, that sort of issue was left to the jury and the experts debated it. And had we had a construction about does draining a wound, is that different than treating a wound? Was that a disclaimer, a disavowal, and the like? None of which was clearly contained in the briefing of KCI below. Instead, they argued for don't construe it, plain and ordinary meaning. Originally, they had some other constructions, but ultimately, when we went to the Markman hearing, they said don't construe it.
Well, we've got, before the time, we've got four pieces of prior art that are really in play here, right, with respect to the obviousness. And I understand the argument you've been making, and it seems to me it deals predominantly, if not entirely, with the fistula issue. With respect to the other three prior art, there's not a fistula or a wound issue, right? That deals with pressure on the wound and whether there's a screen or not and things other than what you're arguing here in terms of the wound claim construction,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. I do want to point out, and my time has expired, I'm eating into Mr. Ray's time.
We'll make sure and keep the time separate so Mr. Ray won't be prejudiced if we carry you over, but
you
we will
correct.
Give Mr. Dunner an equal amount of time as we go beyond your
Thank
time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Johnson article, the Spedman article, the Russian articles, there were a number of other pieces of prior art that were applied to the claims other than Cherik or Jeter. There's some confusion, perhaps, because Cherik or Jeter had multiple pieces of prior art that we relied upon as to what was before the examiner versus the other Cherik or Jeter prior art. And the best Cherik or Jeter prior art was not before the examiner. It was the public uses, the presentations, the poster presentations by Drs. Cheriker and Jeter 10 or more times to other doctors in which they described the improvement in granulation, the improvement in healing of the skin and the like as part of those presentations, and a book chapter that they wrote that qualifies as prior art in which they were more expressive with respect to the results achieved. That's better prior art than the Cheriker-Jeter prior art that was before the examiner.
And you've said that there was at least one piece of the Cheriker-Jeter that did not deal with the fistula, right?
Yes.
Where was that?
That was amongst the various photographs, and I think we put all of these in our reply brief in a way that you could more easily follow them. There was a set of photographs when you look at them, it looks like a fistula because you see the intestine through in the photograph, but there was no hole in the intestine, and he describes it in his testimony as packed with gauze, with a drain in it, as leaving it on until the wound had closed enough. It is true that at some point he stitched it up in order to release the patient from the hospital earlier, which oftentimes happens with all of these. This is what this selected stages of healing issue is about. At some point, you can employ an alternative therapy, and that's what Dr. Cheriker described with respect to the non-fistula application of this device.
So if we were to, just to be sure I understand, if we were to construe, as you suggest, wound to be limited to skin wounds, is that the end of your obviousness appeal?
No, Your Honor. First of all, when you have a fistula, you have a skin wound. And what actually is happening is that two healing processes are occurring. One is occurring in connection with the draining of the wound, which allows and permits, and there's no dispute in the record with respect to this, that improved granulation around the wound occurs. And then there's a second type of healing that occurs as you leave the device on the patient. And you see that in the photographs when you see a wound that is substantially open and you see a series of photographs where the wound has been compressed to only being a small opening. That is the same type of healing that they claim was the intention of the invention here, but it's also taught by the Cheriker-Jeter public uses in presentations and the like that are in the record.
I want to make sure I understand exactly what your contention is with respect to the proper definition of wound. Now, the Stedman definition seems to me to be pretty broad. Trauma to tissue would include presumably a broken leg, not a compound fracture, simply a simple fracture of the fibula.
I don't think bones are considered
tissue
in that same sense. But
cartilage? Cartilage is tissue, right? Wouldn't bone cartilage be tissue? I think
I'm not certain of that.
So you're really talking about soft tissue, and now the second question
the
is...
The wounds have to be open, Your Honor. That is
open as in open, in there has to be some skin penetration involved, I take it.
Yes, Your Honor. Otherwise it doesn't make sense to put a negative pressure device on it.
Right.
The first
well,
place.
At least that you would assume so, right?
Yes.
All right, and so when you say the problem with defining the wound as, not that the judge did this, but the problem with characterizing wounds as skin wounds is that it isn't broad enough to cover skin wounds that also involve deeper trauma, such as the fistula.
Yes, Your Honor. If you limit it to skin wounds, there are a wound includes trauma that's below the surface of the skin, and indeed, if this was just about skin wounds, this invention probably wouldn't make any difference. We're talking about chronic acute wounds that have been substantially open for a period of time, and it's not just in the layer of the skin. So this is not about...
No, we're not talking about scratches here. I understand that. We're talking about severe open draining disturbances of the
correct, Your Honor.
Skin and the subcutaneous layers.
That's correct, right. Your Honor. And in the specification, they give merely examples, but of burns and ulcers and skin graft situations, they're all identified in the specification. The word skin is not used to describe these wounds. They give examples without narrowing the definition of wound. You won't find the word skin in the specification. So while it seems as though it's a position of KCI at this point that there was some error in connection with the failure of the court below to construe the term wound, they argue that it was harmless.
Did they argue at the Markman hearing that the term wound should be construed to be limited to skin wounds?
They did not put that in a proposed definition to the court. During the course of the arguments at Markman, Your Honor, I can't recall whether they used those words as part of their argument. My guess, this goes back a while, is that they probably did, but I'd have to go and look at the record to give you a precise answer to that question.
Very well. Why don't
thank you.
Hear next from Mr. Dunn. Thank you, Mr. Partridge. And Mr. Woodard, could you add 7 minutes and 30 seconds to Mr. Dunner's time in the event that he needs it, please?
May it please the Court, Your Honors. I was going to make a more general statement to get into the obviousness case, but I think I would just as well respond specifically to the points that Mr. Partridge made, and hopefully I'll have time to go back.
If we assume hypothetically that the Stedman Dictionary definition of wound is correct, why is it, in your view, that Cherik or Jeter is not anticipatory? I understand we're talking about obviousness here, but why doesn't it create a prima facie case of obviousness?
Because it is our view that Cherik or Jeter does not treat a wound with negative pressure. What Cherik or Jeter does, and this is true of the public uses, it's also true of the other references, what he has is it's a drainage system. He drains fluid from a fistula.
But the fistulas in Cherik or Jeter, at least many of them, were the result of surgical incisions. So in that sense, they come within the definition of wound in Stedman, right?
Your point is that if fistula is included in what is a wound, is he treating the wound?
Well, a fistula caused by a surgical incision would be within the definition of wound under Stedman, right?
Using the dictionary definition, that is true.
Okay. So if we do hypothetically say that that's the correct definition, then why, when Cherik or Jeter were treating fistulas caused by surgical incisions, wasn't that a prior art reference which created a prima facie case of obviousness?
Well, because there are other limitations that it would not satisfy. It doesn't satisfy, there's evidence to support this on page, in the red brief on page 35, it doesn't contain a screen to prevent overgrowth. It would not make intermittent suction obvious. There are cases in obviousness case for reasons I can go into. It doesn't satisfy the district court's claim construction of impermeable cover, because the district court construed that to have a water vapor transfer rate of less than 836, and there's nothing in there to suggest that. But I would like to address briefly why that definition, that dictionary definition, is not proper. It's not proper because the specifications make absolutely clear, they may not use the word skin, but they use a medical equivalent to skin in the summary of the invention.
Well, before you go to that, could you tell us what you think the correct definition is? Before you justify the definition you're arguing for, could you tell us precisely what the definition is that you think ought to be adopted?
Yes.
How would you read wound to define it in terms of
tissue damage? This is the definition that we have asserted. Tissue damage to the surface of the body, including the epithelial and subcutaneous layers. And the epithelial and subcutaneous layers are skin layers by any dictionary definition.
But that definition says included. It doesn't say it's limited to...
It's to the surface of the body.
That's where you get the skin?
Yes. That's what was intended. It's the surface of the body, and to show you what we mean by surface, We're talking about the epithelial and subcutaneous layers of the skin.
Okay, so I'm sorry, why don't you go ahead and then tell us why that's the correct definition
of
the specification.
Because the patent specification, for two reasons, the patent specification all the way through talks only of skin wounds. Every example is a skin wound. The summary of the invention is a skin wound. And right at the beginning, on column 4, lines 6 through 11, it talks about applying a negative or reduced pressure to a wound over an area sufficient to promote the migration of epithelial and subcutaneous tissue. So all the way through the specs, it talks only of surface skin wounds. Moreover, during the prosecution history of the original of the 081 patent, the distinction was made that Charika Jeter is not a proper reference against the claims because it treated a fistula. It distinguished the kind of definition that would be covered by the Svedman dictionary definition. It also distinguished over another reference. It distinguished over the Svedman reference and basically said the same thing. It does not have a screen to prevent overgrowth, and it talked about the negative pressure simply moving through the device. It's not pressure on the wound. So those are disclaimers, and the case law of this court says that when you have a disclaimer during the prosecution history, the claims should be limited to that disclaimer in both directions, our ability to accuse somebody of infringement and how those claims should be construed. So it is our position that in fact the definition should be as we have said it should be, and that it should not be as in the Svedman dictionary. Now, yes?
I'm sorry. If you're done with that response, I'm curious about how you view the Johnson reference. The briefs don't spend a lot of time on Johnson, but that was a reference that I needed some help interpreting.
The Johnson reference was a skin graft reference.
Right.
And the testimony, our evidence shows that the negative pressure is used to immobilize the skin, not to treat a wound.
To immobilize the graft?
Pardon?
To immobilize the graft in its
to
place.
To immobilize the graft, skin. The skin graft
okay.
over the wound.
All right.
Now, there are...
But it is negative pressure. I mean, it's not doing... Well, earlier you differentiated between drainage and negative pressure. Johnson isn't drainage, I take it.
Johnson is a drainage device.
All right. So it's taking fluid out and immobilizing the graft at the same time. Is
right.
that the idea? Otherwise, the graft would tend to be separated from
yes.
the subcutaneous layer by fluid, and you want to have it
yes.
adhere. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay.
And in the patent, there are several graft examples, skin graft examples. And the negative pressure is applied before the skin graft is put on in order to heal the wound, and then you add the skin graft. In the Johnson device, what they do is they add the skin graft, and then they put the negative pressure on the skin graft to immobilize it. It's a very different system, and the testimony is on the red brief 31 and 32 that, in fact, it is the skin graft that's doing the healing of the wound, it is not the negative pressure. And our point is and has been that this is a JMAL motion, and under the rules of this court, all the facts are to be construed in our favor, and that if there are any factual disputes, they should be resolved in our favor. So for that reason, I don't think Johnson is relevant, and I should mention Your Honors will know that we brought to the attention of the court a recent reexamination request that I just learned about on Saturday. And in that case, all the references that are cited, Charika Jeter and Svedman and Johnson and Davidoff, were at least considered And claims allowed, all the claims allowed, over Davidoff expressly and Spedman. So we think the court can take judicial notice of that, and our position we feel is reinforced by that. Now, they mentioned the public uses, and they said those public uses had information in them that weren't in the cases before the Patent and Trademark Office, and I submit, Your Honors, that in fact, that is not so. Any information they had in them is not really relevant to the appeal. He talked about
those public presentations do talk about...
Pardon?
Those public presentations do go beyond the drainage issue. They do talk about healing the incision, don't they?
Your Honor, they talk about improved granulation. They talk about they talk about a non-fistula patient. And our position is that whatever they talk about was before the examiner in the original prosecution was told about improved granulation of Cherokee-Jeter. And our position is, perhaps I should just explain Cherokee-Jeter because it's really a distinguishable reference. The public uses and the references before the examiner all refer to the same seven patients. And the way it works is you drain a fistula because the fluid from the fistula interferes with healing.
What about the one example in Cherokee-Jeter that didn't involve fistula?
We have pointed out, maybe we didn't point out because we had the red brief. That example, the witness who testified, Dr. Cheriker, was impeached because at his deposition, which was read to the jury, he said the wound for the non-fistula patient was healed with sutures.
Well, I don't think he said. I don't think he said it was healed with sutures. I think he said that the underlying tissue, not at the skin level, was sutured together. I thought that the testimony was that the wound healing, at least on the surface, was the result of the negative pressure rather than sutures. It wasn't sutured at the surface, correct?
I don't know where the sutures, to what the sutures were applied. I am under the understanding that he did not use his technique to heal. There is some healing that takes place in a Cherokee-Jeter system, whether you're talking about the public uses or otherwise, and I really didn't finish my point to explain that. The healing that takes place is if you keep the caustic effluent from the fistula away from the surface of the...
Yeah, but that doesn't relate to this one example that didn't involve a fistula. I mean, you have a problem if that one example, which was a public use, involved the surface of the skin. In other words, that it would fit within your own proposed definition of the word wound. And the suggestion is that somehow the jury found that he wasn't credible, or could have found that he wasn't credible. I'm having a difficult time seeing what the credibility is, because it seemed to me that the testimony and the deposition were not inconsistent with each other.
Your Honors, the suture issue comes up on, I'm looking for it in my notes, $203,978,080. It says, the quote is, the photographs depict an attempt to achieve primary closure by sewing the wound together. Is that right? Yes. And I interpret that to mean, Your Honor, that the healing was not, other than the normal secondary healing, which we acknowledge takes place in a Cherokee-Jeter system, but it takes place It takes place while you're trying to cure a fistula. But in this case, I read that as inconsistent with their argument that the Charak-Jeter system, including the vacuum, was responsible for the wound healing in that non-fistula system. That is the testimony we're relying on.
Mm-hmm.
The let me just go into the last. Do you have any other questions on that point, Your Honor?
No.
Okay. The last point they made was in response to a question that Judge Prost asked, if the court construes the claim to be restricted to a skin wound, do they lose? And Mr. Partridge's answer was, no, there's a secondary type of healing. And that was the point I was getting to. There is no obviousness case based on Charak-Jeter, because what happens there is the effluent is the problem with preventing the wound from healing. And once you stop, once you control the effluent, which is what the drainage system is supposed to do, then the system is allowed to heal. Once that happens, the system, the Charak-Jeter system stops and the wound just heals naturally once you have cured the fistula problem. So anyone with the Charak-Jeter reference in front of him would not think that in a non-fistula system, that system would work. The whole system is keyed to curing, solving a fistula problem, correcting the drainage problem that results from that, which impedes healing. So if you have no fistula, you don't have a drainage problem that impedes healing, there's no reason to use the Charak-Jeter system. And I would note that Charak-Jeter was in fact mentioned in the re-examination, and the examiner nevertheless allowed the claims, except for claim 13, which the examiner did not allow.
If I can just ask one quick question, a follow-up to Judge Bryson's question on Johnson, because I too was had some doubts about Johnson. And that is, it seems that if, I know your answer to him involved the specification, it seems to me there's an example 4 in the specification that's problematic for you to get over. So I was relying, I think one of your fallback arguments seemed to be, well, they use gauze, and gauze doesn't prevent outgrowth, which is necessary for the screen limitation. Am I right about that?
That's
right.
Yes.
But some of the claims don't have the screen limitation, right?
Every one of the claims in the 081 patent has a screen limitation. There's a chart in the back of the red brief, and every one of the claims in the 081 patent has a screen limitation.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of the asserted claims. If you look at the third page from
right.
the back of the red
brief. I'm talking about the 643 then.
Oh, in the 643 patent, that's right. Every claim doesn't have a screen limitation, and for a number of those claims, we rely on other provisions, such as treating a wound or impermeable cover or any one of the other limitations that we have.
But if we think the skin graft comes under the definition of wound under the spec, then what we're left with, the only argument you're left with is the screen, right, the outgrowth question that you distinguish based on the gauze not preventing outgrowth? Am I understanding?
You're saying if you construe their skin graft in Johnson
right.
to be within the claim,
right.
then I missed your...
Then what we're left with, I thought you argued in the brief, but I might be confused with another reference, that you're still left with gauze in Johnson, and that you say it's still distinguishable.
Yes, I
because
said that Johnson...
It doesn't prevent the screen from preventing the outgrowth.
That's exactly right.
Right, but that argument would not apply. If that's the argument we're left with, that would not apply to the 643, all the claims in the 643 patent.
In the 643 patent, there's no screen. Well, there's still
certain claims. Yeah. Not all the claims.
There's still some claims calling for intermittent suction, and there's some claims calling for impermeable cover. So we still have other limitations,
okay.
which we have to apply to. Now, you want to mention that there's one example that's problematical, and what example?
Example 4 seemed to me, I'm going to go back to it in the spec. but in your I can't quite. I mean, the example for the treatment of flaps on column 17 of the
643 patent.
Yeah. I guess I would have a hard time distinguishing the discussion at the end, line 63 through 68. It talks about the flaps were created at a depth immediately below, blah, blah, blah. I guess you might want to repeat the argument you made with respect to flaps, because I was having a hard time.
This is a, as I understand it, this is a treatment of flaps. It's not a skin graft. My understanding is that is not a it's skin flap survival. Nobody has paid much attention to that example, so I don't know that it's been briefed very much.
Okay. Well, in the patent, maybe I was confused, but in column 12, when they talk about flaps, you say they discuss the integration of a flap or a graft. So I thought perhaps those terms were used interchangeably.
I understand that there are some other claims directed to that particular example, and those other claims, if I recall, are at the end of the 643 patent. What claims are they? I understand there are some other claims specifically directed to a flap, Your Honor.
Okay.
And rather than take up, I see I'm running out of...
Well, can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
And I want to come back to this claim construction issue, which is obviously important. In favor of your surface claim construction, you said that Cherker Jeter was distinguished before the examiner on the ground that it involved fistulas. The question I have is, in distinguishing it before the examiner on the ground that it involved fistulas, was the focus on the idea that it was draining the fistula rather than healing the wound?
Yes, it's the statements in the prosecution history talk specifically about the fact that the healing of the wound was secondary rather than primary, and specifically what we said was that Cherker does not disclose any means of directly accelerating the healing process. The only effect that the device disclosed by Cherker et al. Has on wound healing is improved granulation, which is only a secondary effect of draining the wound. In contrast, applicants' claim invention relates to a device for directly accelerating the healing process. That's on page 83510. That's what we said about the Cherker reference.
So that's short of saying that the patent here doesn't cover fistula situations.
Well, it basically says that there's added language. Cherker relates to a wound drainage device and not to a device for promoting wound healing.
Okay, then I understand. I understand what was said. Thank you.
We've occupied you considerably with our questions. If you want to address briefly the infringement issue in order to put that issue in play,
I would like to.
Mr. Ray would probably be happy if you would say something about it so that he can speak.
Fine, Your Honor. Basically, the situation on infringement is this. At the trial, they never applied claims against the accused device. What they did was they basically set forth a practicing the prior art defense. And we submit that practicing the prior art defense is not a proper defense under the case law of this law. They also compared before the jury their device to our device without regard to the claims. They said, is this closer to our to the prior art device, or is it closer to our device? That is not a proper approach to infringement. So what do they do on appeal? They're not even raising the practicing the prior art defense. They're not raising it's closer to one than the other. They raise four different arguments supporting their case. One is that the specs don't disclose Aquaphor or any other non-adhering holding, and our position is it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to disclose. The specification does not have to disclose the specific accused product. The question is, do the claims cover the accused product? They also said that the testimony of Dr. Orgill was conclusory on counteracting force to prevent overgrowth. Is not conclusory. It's reinforcing testimony of two of their witnesses, one of their witnesses, Hoff, for one, and one other witness, who actually said exactly that is what happens when you use a screen, and all he was doing was reinforcing that testimony, and so that doesn't help them.
Let me step in just quickly at Dr. Orgill. Was Dr. Orgill your own KCI's only witness?
Yes, he was our expert. That's exactly right. My point is that they don't really have any independent testimony comparing claims to a product, and they're basically left with these three or four items, which we don't feel are substantial evidence supporting a jury verdict. Now, on the induced infringement, I'd just like to mention two things. One is, there's evidence of some confusion here. There's evidence of direct infringement from the evidence that Blue Sky told its distributors that, and I quote, the use of the intermittent pressure mode on the Versatile 1 was sometimes successful at A204-89.
But that's sort of thin in terms of evidence that there was direct infringement, because they said that the standard was continuous pressure, and they said sometimes intermittent pressure is okay. It seems to me that if there were an instruction to do it in a particular way as a routine matter, you might not need separate evidence of direct infringement. But where you say the routine is continuous pressure, but sometimes intermittent pressure could be used, falls short of proving direct infringement.
Your Honor, if their instructions say use continuous or intermittent, and if we have evidence that in fact they used intermittent, it seems to me that is a solid case for proving
an
infringement.
That's the problem. Whether there was evidence of direct infringement by customers, as opposed to the instructions being used in and of themselves to show inducement. It's that one nurse you're saying that testified to the use of the product with intermittent infringement, intermittent
yes.
pressure?
Yeah. That is our evidence. There's another piece of evidence by, I believe, a nurse, which they have challenged, and rather than to get involved in a debate on that, I'm focusing on this piece of evidence, 204-829. That's our evidence of direct infringement induced infringement.
Induced, right. But are there two nurses or one? The one nurse that I was thinking about, and I think is the same nurse that Judge Dyke is thinking about, as to whose testimony your opposing counsel said, well, they weren't referring to the accused device. She wasn't referring to the accused
device.
There was
a debate as to whether,
right.
That may have been Lockhart. I don't remember the name of the nurse.
But was there a second nurse?
There may have been. I don't know.
Oh,
your
okay.
Honor.
Right.
But you said you're not relying on the first nurse.
We're not relying on
okay.
that.
Right.
Keep in mind that there are three kits. There are six kits altogether, three without the Aquaphor and three with the Aquaphor.
Right.
As to the kits with the Aquaphor, we submit that is a direct infringement by Blue Sky, and the Golden Blunt case, which we cite, it says direct infringement can be inferred from the sale of kits with instructions where no evidence that users ignored instructions. That's as to the use of Aquaphor. So we feel as to three kits, we have a solid case based on that. As to the other, we are relying on this evidence that I told you about, 820-4829.
Mm-hmm. Very well. Why don't we let you sit down now if you're at a stopping point. We will reserve some additional, I suppose, surrebuttal time for
Thank you.
And we will give Mr. Partridge, who I think is up next, And then we give, did you want Mr. Ray to go first here?
It's your choice, Your Honor. Mr. Ray could address infringement. I could then address invalidity, or we could do invalidity.
Well, I tell you what, since we've just been talking about infringement, maybe we'd better continue with Mr. Ray, and we'll give Mr. Ray an extra, Mr. Whittaker, could you give Mr. Ray an extra 4 minutes, and we'll give Mr. Partridge an extra 4 minutes. He had 5, so he'll go up to 9. Mr. Partridge had 3, so he'll go up to 7.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I do want to address the screen means claims. That is the vast majority of the claims. There's only 2 claims that are not under the category of screen means. First of all, there were more than 6 kits. There were up to 18 kits. And now, in the gray brief on page 7, KCI admits the judgment is correct with regard to some of the kits. They are not appealing with regard to some.
Maybe I'm not understanding. I thought they were saying that the method claims about intermittent pressure were an alternative ground for finding infringement of the kits that didn't satisfy the screen means for screening limitation. Am I misunderstanding?
I'm not sure. The point I was making was that there are kits that have no screens.
Right, and I thought as to those, they were saying there's an alternative ground for finding infringement because there was induced infringement of the intermittent pressure claims.
There are some claims within the screen claims that require intermittent suction also.
No, but I thought there was under the other patent, they were saying there was infringement of these intermittent pressure claims, which applied to the kits that didn't have the screen means.
Yes, there's 2 claims now that are in the 643 patent. Claim 14 and Claim 29.
Okay, I'm only addressing your statement. You said they concede that the judgment was correct as to some of the kits. It seemed to me that they weren't conceding that. They were saying as to those kits that didn't satisfy the screen means limitation that they could still rely on these alternative claims that where there was induced infringement because of intermittent pressure.
Well, except their brief is a little more conciliatory than that. At the bottom of page 7 of their gray brief, they say that KCI is not challenging the jury's non-infringement verdict with respect to every accused product. Now, I take that because I take that as a clear concession that some of the products, they cannot make out an infringement case. But even if we view that as, okay, maybe they think there's inducement, the problem we have is that some of the kits don't contain Aquaphor, and another kit isn't even used with Aquaphor. So even if they had an inducement theory, the Dermavix kit isn't used with Aquaphor ever. So the problem we have here is that KCI never, ever sought any separate relief with regard to different groupings of the products. So it is impossible, I think, at this stage now to break up the products when...
Why? Why can't we, if we're persuaded by the evidence, if the evidence is such that there was absolutely nothing to support a jury verdict with respect to 10 out of 20 accused products, why aren't we free to set aside the jury verdict with respect to those 10?
Well, that has never been done before, and I believe this court's case law is pretty good suggesting that this court won't do that. And in fact, the LMW case at 471 Fed 3rd at 1317.
It's a summary judgment case. It's not a jury verdict case.
Well, I think that's helpful, more helpful to us than the jury verdict situation, because clearly there's substantial evidence to support the verdict on some of the products. They concede that. But more importantly, and so we don't get caught up in this procedural issue, the jury was certainly free to find that the aquifer gauze did not meet the claim construction of the screen means. Now, Mr. Dunner made a case here to you today that somehow it was the defendant's fault, or the defendant made an argument that doesn't justify non-infringement. But it was the plaintiff who bore the burden on infringement, and the plaintiff's only witness was Dr. Orville, and Dr. Orville did not apply the claim construction. He never said that the aquifer gauze applies a counteracting force to prevent overgrowth. Never said that. So you'll notice what KCI is doing in their brief, and Mr. Dunner did it here today. They have to go to the invalidity expert of Dr. Huff, Medela's invalidity expert, in order to make it seem like there was some testimony that the aquifer gauze applies a counteracting force to prevent the overgrowth of tissue. The problem with that, number one, it doesn't say what Mr. Dunner says it says. What Dr. Huff was talking about was the prior art that used fluffed gauze to fill the dead space. It's the fluffed gauze below the impermeable cover in the prior art that applies forces. Now,
what kind of gauze? Do you happen to know what kind of gauze is used in Johnson? Prior art in Johnson?
No, but I
thought KCI's position with respect to Johnson is that the gauze didn't satisfy the screen limitation. But
well,
I don't know what. Right now, I'm confused as to what the differences in gauze are and which one we're talking about.
So am I. They could not make out an infringement case and at the same time account for the prior art gauzes. That's precisely the point. I am just as confused as you are. All I know is they made an infringement case that rested on the presence of Aquaphor, which is simply an impregnated gauze. But they don't want to say that the fluffed gauze applies the counteracting force, because the minute they make that argument, there's many prior arts that all use fluffed gauze to fill the dead space. And that is the real crux of this case, in that the infringement case and the invalidity case are incomprehensible relative to one another. They cannot draw the line of including Aquaphor and excluding the prior art, because Aquaphor is just gauze with petroleum jelly on it.
Let me go back to the first procedural point, however, which you... So is your view that under our case law, L&W and whatever else there is, if they had objected to the jury instruction, would that be sufficient?
That would certainly make a major difference. In this case, what I find makes this case a little different than any of the other cases so far, the court specifically told the parties, recommended that the verdict be more specific so that we'll be able to carve out, which is the phrase the district court judge used. The district court was concerned, and the defendants were concerned, that the plaintiff's expert never made any quantity in order to base the damages case. Their expert just lumped them all together, as did the opening statement, the closing, the Dr. Orville. Nobody differentiated among the products.
That sounds like an argument that they didn't prove damage rather than liability. And
well,
that the jury didn't reach the damages question.
Correct. And that's why the SealFlex case that they discuss is not really helpful. When there's a verdict of infringement, then the court has the ability to remit it or lower the damages amount. But it's a different situation when the jury finds no infringement. And here the jury was entitled to find no infringement. The aquifer gauze, and the reason why it was confusing whether we were talking prior art or the non-infringement defense is because they couldn't draw that line. They couldn't draw the line. But my only point was the judge gave the parties the option. He implored them to be more specific in the verdict form, and they both declined. Now, that's not oversight by anyone's part, because if they had found infringement, they would get the benefit of it covering all the products. And the unfairness that they are arguing, and I know there's no case directly on point, but let's assume that the jury, that there was infringement of one or more products. Let's assume that for sake of this discussion. The problem is the plaintiff would always get two bites at the apple. He'd go for all the products, maybe lose, get a partial reversal, and then, you know, he has a tails I win, heads you lose type scenario. That's unfair. And
but he's taking a risk because he may have given you that option to double deal, because you know if he had won with respect to infringement, you'd be here arguing the same way he's arguing, right? that some of the products do not infringe, clearly do not infringe, and there's no...
But then we'd have the option of scaling back the damages. You see, the problem is we don't get that luxury when the jury finds no infringement. The point is, the plaintiff who bore the burden of proof never differentiated among the products. Never once. And so all we have is a jury verdict form that simply says, the versatile one system. That's it. And now they're conceding some products don't infringe and are coming up here hoping to get a reversal on some of the products. I think that's improper. I think that games the system. I think that's a waiver. But regardless, the jury in this case easily could have concluded that aquifer gauze alone does not meet the district court's claim construction of the screen means. And that definition required a counteracting force to prevent the overgrowth of the tissue. Never once does Dr. Orber ever say that aquifer gauze accomplishes such a result.
Apparently Mr. Partridge doesn't agree with you on that.
Oh, I think he agrees with me.
Yeah.
Because the prior art and the Huff testimony always...
But isn't his argument for obviousness that it does satisfy those limitations, the screen means limitations?
Well, if I understand his argument, it's in combination with the fluff gauze, which is in the prior art. Their infringement theory was aquifer alone, because they didn't want to include the fluff
but
gauze.
But you said that aquifer and fluff gauze are the same, right?
In isolation, but the problem is we're talking about them used together. Aquifer gauze actually is just a slice of gauze with petroleum jelly. Mm-hmm. The fluff gauze is many, many feet packing the wound with the impermeable cover over it. And clearly you need the fluff gauze to have the counteracting force. That's what's in the prior art. But they didn't want to say that was an infringement. They wanted to say aquifer alone is the infringement. It makes no sense. That's why I think Judge Prost and I are confused as to how they can draw the line on infringement and validity. They can't.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. And now, Mr. Partridge, we gave
yes.
you, I think, okay. Let me make sure that we're allocating the time correctly here.
Is it 7 minutes?
I think we need one more minute, Mr. Woodard, for Mr. Partridge. All right, there we go.
Okay. May I deal with a couple of simple issues first? The first concerns the skin graft question you asked about the patent. And if you look at claim 37, which is on appendix page 337, this is a claim not asserted in the case that's addressing attaching a graft to the wound. It's not a flap, it's a graft to the wound, and that's what one of the examples is in the specification. And indeed, in this re-exam that Mr. Dunner referred to, this claim, I haven't studied the last action in the re-exam, but this claim was amended substantially in order to distinguish the prior art.
Claim 37 is a column 26?
Yes,
having a hard time finding it.
Claim 38. Claim 38, right. I misspoke. So that's the first issue. And the second concerns the re-exam itself. Filed by a third party, and as I understand it, there are several re-exams pending, and the one that they notified the court about just recently concerns, I believe, an application of a Svedman article and a Svedman patent and a combination of those two, different from anything that we argued below. We did argue the Svedman article, but not inconsistent with that. And that re-examination, I believe, is an ex-party re-examination and public uses and presentations of the sort, which are among the principal prior art we presented to the jury below, of course, are not before the examiner. Great confusion caused below, because Cheriker Jeter is a multiplicity of different types of prior art, and so we should be careful in talking about the re-exam as to what is actually before the examiner. Mr. Dunner also talked about, in response to some questions, about the limitation treating a wound and what a definition or interpretation they would propose for it. And the court correctly noted that in their interpretation below, they included the language including without limitation, not, it wasn't excluding a fistula. It was including the epithelial and subcutaneous
layers. Now, why'd they do that?
What about the prosecution history? We've got to get to the heart of these things, but I don't want you to consume all your time with the small stuff.
And Your Honor, that's exactly where I was going. Mm. They have dependent claims that address a canister for collecting drained fluid from the wound. They accused us of infringing some of those claims in this case.
What's the point? I don't understand the point of that. The question is whether they distinguished Cherkajeter in the prosecution on the ground that it involved fistulas. And if they did, what did they say about it? Did they say that Cherkajeter is different because it involves drainage, or did they say it's different because it doesn't promote wound healing?
With respect to the Cherkajeter article that was before the examiner on appendix page 3510, they talk about what Cherkajeter relates to. And they say it relates to a wound drainage device and not to a device for promoting wound healing, and then acknowledge that that there may be some secondary effect with respect to wound healing. It does not rise to the level of a disavowal or a disclaimer, and indeed, they did not argue that below. With respect to their claim construction, they wanted to have it both ways, and they included a limitation that was not exclusive with respect to draining a wound, which is also part of healing a wound. Though Cherkajeter public uses and presentations went beyond the mere draining and talked about other aspects of healing a wound, the truth of the matter is these claims as written and as argued before the court below do not even exclude draining a wound as an aspect of treating a wound. Indeed, they include canisters to collect the fluid that's drained from the wound. So I don't think that they can come here and now ask this court to construe this limitation as excluding fistulas. Of course, if you decided to do that, if you thought there was a disavowal or a disclaimer, I think we'd have to go back, as in O2 Micro, and visit the issue again with another jury. I don't believe we need to do that. I think this is more like the Pharmastem case, in which you were able to rule on obviousness and make a determination. Here, with respect to at least some of the claims, claims 13, claim 16, and some others, there are no differences that are material. And with respect to those claims, I think easy for you to enter a judgment of obviousness. With respect to some of the other claims, we are left with...
What about Mr. Denner's argument with respect to Cherkajeter and the one example of public use that didn't involve fistulas? He says that involved suturing the skin. Is that correct or not correct?
Your interpretation of that evidence is consistent with my own, Your Honor. There was I believe it was the small intestine that had so protruded from the wound that he needed to get it back into the wound, and he employed sutures, underlying sutures, in order to do so, and then applied his, but there was no opening in that intestine, and then applied his device to facilitate the healing process. My recollection is that at some point, as the photographs show, when the wound was sufficiently closed, a doctor has a choice. Do we keep the patient on the negative pressure wound therapy device for an extra week or 2 weeks to close it completely, or is it in a position such that the skin will allow for the suturing the wound at that point so we can send the patient home? And there is evidence in the record about those sorts of choices that doctors make. But the point about the non-fistula patient is that the application of this device facilitated the healing of the epithelial and subcutaneous layers, as well as dealing with the problem with the intestine projecting from the wound. I would point the court, because I think that the reply brief that we submitted walks you through the public use evidence and the photographs along with the testimony related to that in a very
easy to follow, clear way that I think will enable the court to conclude, as we do, that this is a case in which there isn't a dispute with respect to those facts, and that there's simply legal error because the court below never did an analysis in response to our motion for judgment after the jury verdict. So at least as to some claims, we believe you can enter judgment. As to other claims, I think you can. You may have to get to the substantial evidence issue in the process, but I think even if you do, as to those claims, the added devices are used in their normal, predictable way, their known way of use. There isn't something with respect to those detailed claims that really adds to the non-obviousness of this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Dunner, I think you have about 3 minutes left, if I've kept track, roughly at least.
Your Honor, I'm restricting myself to infringement.
Very good.
Since I think
that's
what I'm supposed to do.
That's great.
I just want to make sure we're on the same
page. We are.
Mr. Ray talked about the all or nothing point that he made. He cited the L&W case because we are seeking a finding of infringement only as to six kits, and we're not seeking it as to other kits. The all or nothing cases that he cited, three of them, L&W,
Is this correct that there's some kits who admit there's no infringement? Or
no, we're just not pursuing them on appeal. We are restricting our appeal to six kits. We're not saying that there's no infringement. We're just restricting ourselves to six kits. But even if we said there was no infringement, I submit there's no difference. The point is, the cases he's talking about, the all or nothing case, L&W being a perfect example, the party came in and he said, as to one product, it has a certain feature. And then he said, all the products have that same feature. He put all the products in the same basket. We have not done that. The evidence, including a chart from the defendants, shows which charts have gauze, which Aquaphor gauze, which charts do not have Aquaphor gauze, and the dialogue came up in the context of damages. And the base that chart is on page A10234. It shows the kits and it shows which ones have and which ones haven't. We're not putting all our eggs in one basket. This is not an all or nothing case. If we can prove infringement of a single kit, we are entitled to go to the jury on damages, and then the jury will determine whether we get a lot of damages or less damages because we're only asserting a single kit. In this case, we're asserting six kits. The case law, none of those cases deals with a fact pattern like us, like ours, where we in fact have distinctions based on specific kits and what those kits contain. So I think that all or nothing argument is a red herring. Going back to the testimony as to whether or not there is a screen which basically imposes a counteracting force to prevent overgrowth, they never challenged that below. That is not a point they challenged. The testimony of Orgill basically says just that, and the testimony also says that the fluffed saline-soaked cotton gauze placed over the drain in Charica Jeter simply absorbs the drainage and would not prevent tissue overgrowth. So there is evidence in the record, and there's no evidence contrary to that, because they never have taken the position that that particular clause did not infringe. I think that basically is all I have to say, unless there are questions from the bench.
Thank you very much, and we thank all counsel. The case is submitted.